Disclaimer. This podcast is my own, and the views expressed by me and my guests on this podcast do not reflect the opinions of PSA Collectors or any other company that engages me for appraisal services. Neither myself nor my guests provide any financial or investment advice on this podcast, and any discussions of valuations for collectibles, either in the past or the present, does not guarantee future performance. Enjoy the show. Welcome to another episode of the Sports Appraiser Podcast. I am your host, Michael Osaki, and today we have a special guest. You know him. I love him. Jeremy Lee from Canada. Jeremy, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Thank you for being here, of course. And I have so many questions for you, but one of the first questions I have is, you've been in the hobby for quite a long time, and you're doing it now full time, which is a dream job that many of us listening and watching today would envy of. So what is some of your advice to listeners that are maybe in the hobby part time or want to maybe do this full time, whether it's a dealer, a buyer, whatever it may be? What advice do you have for them?
Really, To me, it comes down to, you know, you gotta chase what you love doing. And if you can find a way into this hobby, into the industry to make a living doing something you enjoy, then that's what's going to make you successful. I think you have to be able to look at it as not being work. I think that's one of the keys. It's been the key for me. I didn't endeavor to, you know, retire from my original career and move into this full time. I did not plan to do that. But as I started doing sports card content, but over 5 years ago now, you know, one thing just sort of led to another, and it proved to be something that I could actually turn into a career. And I, again, I don't feel like I'm working when I work all the time. I don't feel like it's work, but I work all the time. So I think that would be my advice. Having some contacts, knowing a few people along the way will certainly help as you knock down doors and, you know, look for advice or maybe to accelerate your path. If you know a few people, that'll help as well. So, but that you kind of have to maybe be a little bit lucky for.
Passion. So as with any job, right, it's all about the passion, the hustle, the hard work. You got to be out there. You got to give it your all. You got to love what you do. Now, you attend a lot of card shows on an annual basis. How many do you go to? Where are they at? And also, what is the main reason for you attending? Is it buying cards? Is it selling cards? Is it accepting consignments for slab sharks? What is it?
Well, first of all, it's where I want to be. You know, I've been going to card shows for my whole life. Back, my first card show I attended would have been in around the mid-80s as a teenager. So nowadays, though, you know, for the past several years, I've been attending the Sport Card Expo in Toronto twice a year. Been doing that since 2000 or 2001. I go to the Edmonton Expo now, the Montreal Expo. There's a couple cards. There's the Edmonton Expo I'll be at in a couple weeks. There's a few local shows here in Calgary. And of course, I attend the National in the U.S., wherever it is every year. I've been to the Burbank show a few times. And I've been to the Philly show, which I loved. And I'm dying to get down to the Dallas show one of these times. I've never been there, but you know, why do I go? You know, well, again, it's where I want to be. I love the card show atmosphere. It's my favorite place to be in the world, Michael. But it has taken on a more important meaning for me, I would say, since, you know, over the last three or four years. I retired from my profession in summer of 2022. So we're 3 years later now. And being at card shows, it serves a few purposes. You know, one is obviously to be there and to socialize and network and see all my friends, to buy cards, to look for cards. When I go down to the National in the U.S., I don't sell cards. I don't bring cards across the border anymore. In Canada, of course, I buy and sell at card shows. And over the past year, you mentioned Slab Sharks. I've taken on a role as consignment director with Slab Sharks. So now when I am at card shows, I am also there taking in consignments for Slab Sharks and along with, you know, shopping for myself and doing a little bit of buying and selling as well.
Now, I have never been to a card show in Canada. Let's say I was to attend one of those shows. How many hockey cards would I see versus baseball and football? Is it primarily skewed to hockey?
It used to be, but it's not necessarily anymore. You know, we're seeing a lot of basketball and football. Baseball, you see baseball, but more on the vintage side, not as much on the modern side. Of course, there's a lot of TCG. That has become a big part of all the shows that I happen to attend. So, you know, hockey is certainly going to be the sport that is most well represented, but it's not 80% hockey like it used to be. It's maybe 40% hockey, 30% hockey nowadays, relative to everything in the room, if you're including the TCG. If you're just carving out the sports, I'd say you're more than that 40. Yeah, you're still 40 to 50% hockey at a Canadian card show.
Now, a few minutes ago, you mentioned the National, which for the next 3 years will be in Chicago, which is my hometown. So, of course, selfishly, I'm really excited about that. How many Nationals have you been to? And then also, can you give one tip for people who have already been to a National and then one tip to someone who's never been to a National that will be attending this year?
Yeah. Well, I've been to, I think this will be my 18th or 19th National this year. I love the National. Absolutely love the National. It's a 5-day show. It's the end of any big show, Michael. I just can't wait for the next year. Now, the National is huge. You know, you can cover the whole show floor probably in a day. You're not going to get to see everything and look at everything in detail, but you're going to be able to cover the whole show floor at least. Advice to someone who's already been to the National, you know, that's a great question. There's a couple of things I would say. You know, there are the easy answers to this, Michael, like, you know, wear good shoes and pack yourself some water. Everyone gives that advice. My best advice for someone who's been there is bring with you a magnifying glass, like a loop, a little jeweler's loop, something like this that can just, you know, fit in your pocket and help you look at cards closer. Make sure it could. And then I was going to say, because, you know, there's not often great light in there. Well, also bring a flashlight. This is something no one ever says, but bring a flashlight. I'm not talking about a big, bulky flashlight, something you can put in your little pocket, in your front pocket. You know, one of those this long, but that skinny. They're usually metal or whatever. Bring one of those, because when you're looking at cards at the National, especially at the Stevens Center in Chicago, there are pockets of that show floor that are not as well lit as others. And when you're looking at a card, you know, if you're spending $5, you might not need to worry so much. But when you're spending significant money on a sports card, you want to be able to see what condition that card is in, even if it's in a graded holder. That doesn't change anything for me. I think you still want to, especially in lower grades, when you know there are defects on the card, you want to be able to identify what they are. See if you agree with the grading company's assessment, because they're not, you know, grading is subjective and inconsistent at best. So you want to maybe have a good look and see just how the card really presents. So I don't ever hear people giving that advice, bring a flashlight, but I think that's something that I would tell someone who's been there before and someone who hasn't been there before. But specifically, if you haven't been to the National before, some advice I often hear people say is, you know, there's so much to see. And if you've got a budget, you're going to want to deploy that budget optimally. Well, a lot of people will tell you, you know, walk around the floor, have a notepad, take notes of what card you saw and where it was that you want to purchase, you know, do a circuit, maybe go have lunch, think about things, decide what card you want to buy, and then go back and purchase the one that is the most special to you. Well, the problem with that is that, you know, that card is likely going to be gone when you go back. So my advice is don't take that approach, because you're maybe going to be disappointed. Maybe. You might not be. It depends how much you want something. But if the card you see, if you walk into the National on the Wednesday, the first day, you see at the first booth, you see, you know, the most beautiful 1969 Nolan Ryan card you've ever seen that you want to purchase, and it's exactly what you're looking for, and maybe the price is $10 or $20 too high, but, you know, that's the one you want, buy it, because the best cards sell fast. And if you take that original advice, you walk around, you see a bunch of other cards, you go have lunch, and you're like, no, that was the card I want for this show. It was the first one I saw that I liked, but that's the one I want. That card was likely gone 20 minutes after you walked away from that table in the first place. So my advice is, don't think that whatever you like is going to be there later on in the day. It just doesn't work that way. People are out, they're hungry, they're sniffing out the best cards and the best cards for the grade, popular cards, and they are buying them. And so you might blow your budget in the first half hour, but I think you'll be happier that way than if you come back and every card you wanted is gone.
I love your advice on the flashlight and the loop, because as you know, not all cards are graded equally, right? You can look at a PSA 3, and one PSA 3 looks completely different from another PSA 3. Maybe one of them has a lot of staining. Maybe one of them has a large, who knows what it is. So, yeah. And to your point, as far as the lighting goes at the Stevenson's Convention Center, you're spot on there. So again, a veteran like you that's been there 18, 19 times to the National, you know all the different venues and all the different intricacies associated with each. Now, at the National, have you ever been to a trade night? And what are your thoughts on the trade nights?
Yeah, I went to my first National trade night in 2019, I believe. And I thought it was awesome. I walked in, it was a nice bright room with high ceilings, and there were a couple of food stations and just a ton of round tables, and people were camped out putting out their cards. And it was fun just to walk around and just kind of, you know, take a look at all the tables and what was there. And I think they're a wonderful opportunity for anybody and everybody to kind of display their cards and to see who might be interested in them so that they can make some trade. So, you know, on the show floor itself, it's harder. The vendors pay rent, where the attendees just pay admission. So they don't have the right to set up their cards. The trade night sort of balances that out a little bit while not infringing on the vendors and what they are paying for. So I think it's important that there's that separation. I was also at the trade night in Cleveland last year, and it was a humongous facility downstairs at the center. And it was just so much action and the vibes and the excitement and the people running around from table to table. There were some breaker stations happening and giveaways. And the best part about trade nights, Michael, nowadays is that, you know, you go to these multi-day card shows that you travel to, you stay in hotels, and at the end of the card show, at 5 or 6 o'clock, the experience isn't over now. It continues into 2 or 3 in the morning, whether it's at the organized trade nights or back at the hotel lobbies where people ultimately congregate as well. So you're not just going to a card show. These are true industry conventions now that take over the areas that they are held in. And by areas, I mean the conference centers and the hotels and the restaurants. And it's just a wonderful social opportunity to network, meet more people, and build out your overall hobby experience. I think they're wonderful.
A couple of years ago at the Rosemont, I had a friend that was in town, not for the convention, but she's in marketing. And they had a little convention / meeting at one of the hotels, because it's next to O'Hare. And she calls me the next day. She's like, Michael, were you part of this like card show or whatever? There were kids everywhere in suitcases, like trading cards at midnight. She goes, it was incredible. She goes, Michael, I knew you were a sports appraiser, But like, I didn't know that this was such a big, like, hobby. I'm like, it's not so much a hobby anymore. It's, this is like big business.
You can call it a hobby, and it is a hobby for so many, but the hobby lives within the industry, and it's so much more than just that. And a lot of people who are very protective of our hobby and maybe its earlier roots, they're not so crazy about the fact that it's an industry. But the fact of the matter, Michael, as you well know, is it's always been an industry. It's always been, it just maybe wasn't its own. It was a confectionery industry or a tobacco industry or a bubblegum industry. And then it became, the industry turned from the sports card being a premium that was included with a purchase of some confection. Now those premiums became the industry themselves because they're so awesome and we love them so much. But you can't kid yourself anymore. This is not just a hobby. This is an industry, and many of the collectors have become profit-oriented as well. So it's a hobby that has the dynamics of industry at its grassroots level and a pure industry at the sort of highest level.
Now, every weekend, you're live on your podcast going through some of the live auctions that are ending. Sometimes you'll have guests on going through, whether it's Fanatics and some of these other auction houses. Have you ever, and you've been doing this for years now, every weekend, is there one item that completely has like blown your mind that you're seeing this item being auctioned live in real time? Maybe it blows your mind from a rarity perspective, or maybe it blows your mind because the price realized was 3 or 4x that you thought it would be, or maybe the opposite. Saw this great hockey card that was like, went for so cheap, and you're like, oh my gosh, how did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I've covered so many auctions that, well, we talked earlier about, you know, moving into this area full time, and it's really the auction coverage content that I do that is what has become the service that I provide. So I'm partnered with several auction companies now, and, you know, I've seen cards sell too cheap. I've seen cards sell for too much. And I think what really captures my interest the most, you know, to the nature of your question, is back in the days of the pandemic when we were seeing, you know, I would be covering auctions for PWCC or Fanatics Collect, and we would see cards sell for, you know, $3 or $4 million, and these cards would have logo men on them, or, you know, RPAs of LeBron James with patches, memorabilia embedded in them. And I think the thing that surprised me the most was that a lot of times these memorabilia pieces aren't actually from games. They're maybe from jerseys that the player put on quickly for a moment, or they don't even know where these memorabilia pieces come from. You know, to me, if I'm going to buy a sports card that has a piece of memorabilia in it, I want that memorabilia to be game used. That's what, you know, in 1996, when Upper Deck, you know, kind of put out the first game used jersey cards, those jersey pieces were from games that were played, official NHL games, and official MLB games for baseball, or NFL games for football. And then 97 with basketball as well. These were game used. Nowadays, they're not necessarily game used. They're from photo shoots, or, you know, maybe they just have a stack of jerseys and the player puts it on, takes it off, puts it on, takes it off, or they're just off the rack. And it's just mind blowing to me that these cards that contain memorabilia that is not game used can sell for, you know, $1 to $4 million sort of thing. That was happening a lot, and that kind of blew my mind. Now, you're asking, you know, also anything really specific. You know, there's been times where I'm watching cards sell and I'm talking about them, and I really like a card. Maybe it's a card that I do truly love. We've seen, you know, and I collect all sports, Michael, but hockey is my favorite sport that I collect. But I mean, I've been collecting baseball, football, and basketball cards since 1981, you know, opening packs as a kid. But there are some cards that have been selling recently that are selling for more than I expect them to sell. We just had an Alexander Ovechkin Cup RPA Gold out of 8 sell for $381,000. And that was a landmark sale for the hockey segment. So it did surprise me that it sold for that much, but I also think that it's deserved. That card contains a piece of memorabilia that is actually game worn. And if you put it against the top sales in other sports, you know, it's maybe 10%. And those ones, in many cases, aren't even game used. So that's what sticks out to me the most. And I, you know, this is how I collect myself. I'm not willing to, my collection doesn't, you know, I've got several memorabilia cards and not a single card in my collection is not game used.
I feel like that non-game used, those cards should have been banned. I understand that these are for-profit companies that have to make money, but it seems so silly. It's like, what's the point of just putting in, like you said, a photo shoot that maybe the player hasn't even worn, even though his name is on the back? That's like borderline criminal to me. But you know, people still spend a lot of money on those. Anyways, people I know send you DMs and emails every single day, Jeremy. People are really interested in what you do and what you have to say. What are some like the top two or maybe the top question that people ask you? Is it, should I get this card graded, or you think this autograph is real, or just kind of walk me through what you get on a daily basis from people?
Yeah, well, one of them you said there is, should I buy this card? People will often send me, just the other day, I mean, it happens all the time, like you mentioned, but just 2 days ago, somebody sent me a picture of a card that is currently at auction. It's a Gretzky, and it's a Wayne Gretzky rookie card. This particular collector, who is somebody I've known for a few years, is looking to add an OPC Gretzky to their personal collection. This person lives over in Asia. They want a Wayne Gretzky rookie card. There's a nice one at auction right now. They sent me a picture and they said, what do you think of this for my PC? I get that all the time. What do you think of this? What do you think of that card? You know, and listen, these cards are almost always graded, almost always by PSA. But people are starting to recognize, just again, you said earlier, you know, like not all PSA 3s are the same. And that's completely true. Something a lot of people don't understand about grading, I find, is that as you go down the grading scale, it's a pyramid. It's a pyramid in terms of the diversity of conditions that the card can be in. A PSA 10 is a narrow, it's a narrow grading band. You know, there's only a few different things that can happen to a card that can keep it within the PSA 10 grade. As you go down, the range widens as far as how a card will look. So, you know, PSA 9s, you're going to see a bit more variability. As you get down to the ones, twos, and threes, you can have a PSA 1. One can look like a 7, and the other one can look like it was crumpled up and flattened back out. And that's because of the technical reasons for grading. So I often have people send me pictures of cards and I say, how is this one for the grade? Because they know that I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of these cards within the grade point. So I get that question quite a bit. And in this particular case, I said, you know, I don't like that one. I don't like that one for the grade. And here's why. Here are the reasons why. If I like it, I'll tell you. I've told people I love this one for the grade. So the biggest question I get is really that. And now I've become sort of known as a Wayne Gretzky rookie card expert, because I will do when I'm doing these live streams, I will do these in-depth analysis of the condition of the card. And I'll zoom in, I'll show people what I'm seeing and why what I think of the card. So it's really become a lot of these messages I get are specific about Wayne Gretzky cards. Again, as the one I just mentioned, but then people will send me pictures of Gretzky's and say, is this real? Do you think this one is real? Or, you know, how should I sell this card? They'll send me their Gretzky rookie that they've had since they were a kid. And they'll ask me, what should I do with it? What's the best way to sell this card? So you're right, though. Messages are coming through daily, and it's going to be, how do I sell this card, or what do you think of this particular copy?
Let me ask you one final question before I know you brought one or two items for me to appraise. So my final question to you, Jeremy, is what, if anything, do you wish you could change in the hobby?
I knew this question was coming, Michael, and it's a fun question. What do I wish I could change in the hobby? You know, there's several things from different perspectives, you know, like, I wish that there was no way for patch cards to be tampered with. I wish there was no way for sport, for any card to be altered or tampered with. I wish human grading was more consistent, you know, that would be wonderful. And then I guess from a maybe just not as important as those things, I wish there were other ways to display our cards, you know, because cards should not be out in the light very often. The card itself can discolor, autographs can and will fade in many cases. I kind of wish there were, and there are some really creative ways, but I haven't seen the perfect way to display a collection yet. And so a little bit of creativity and innovation there, perhaps. But really, the hobby, I think, is in a wonderful place, you know, with all the social media. Listen, Michael, I mean, doing what I do, you're now entering the podcast world. You're going to forge more relationships. And when you see people in person, it's going to be different because you've had them on your podcast. You know, that I've done over 800 episodes of my show and of my various shows that I do. And I've had probably 300 to 400 people come through the doors of my show, maybe more now. And I wouldn't trade that for anything because, you know, I've known you for several years now. I'd just be probably only because I started doing my content in April of 2020. I probably wouldn't know you otherwise. So the hobby's a wonderful place to build relationships, friendships with people who have something in common with each other. And that's the best. I mean, my best friends in the world are through the hobby. I have a few who are also through, you know, growing up, but my hobby friends are the friends of mine that I enjoy talking to the most because no matter what else is going on in our lives, we have this love of collecting sports cards in common. And I mean, what, there's nothing better than that, Michael. I have a feeling you might feel similarly.
Yeah, you're a great friend of mine and you're a great steward of the hobby. So much appreciated there. I'm excited though. Without further ado, I know you told me you brought in one or two items that you want me to appraise for you. What did you bring me, Jeremy?
Yeah, so these aren't cards, Michael. Honestly, when it comes to cards, I can appraise my own cards. So with this opportunity with you, I wanted to bring you something different. Now, I love to collect sports cards, but I also like to collect sort of hobby adjacent items. And I don't have many. I don't have many, and I do not collect memorabilia outside of two or three pieces. But what I brought you are some unique items, and I could only actually physically reach two of them, but I have five altogether. And these are original display boxes that were issued. These are gum display boxes, but made by companies that made sports cards as well. So this is a as you can see here, it's a bubble gum box called Chums, but these were produced by the Opeachy Company, made in Canada. So here's one of them. These are the original boxes. Now they are filled with styrofoam and then heat sealed. So they are really nice display pieces. So this is an Opeachy one. And then this is also by the Opeachy, but look at the art on this. This is wow. 1 cent gypsy bubble gum.
Beautiful.
Now, and this is also by the Opeachy Company. So, you know, as a collector of Opeachy cards growing up, these original Opeachy items to me are just super cool. I have three more. They're just too high up for me to grab. One's a Fleer box, one's from Hamilton Gum, and one I believe is by Parkhurst. But these are the two that I was able to bring to you today, and I have no idea what they are worth. I purchased them probably 12 years ago from a gentleman named Bobby Burrell, who is a well-known hockey historian in Canada who has several, you know, again, hobby adjacent type of items. And I bought those from him and I've had them on display for over a decade. So I sort of have a memory of what I purchased them for. But yeah, I'm curious to know if they have any value in today's market.
First off, I love how both of those boxes are on brand for you, because what I mean is they're both Canadian Opeachy. It'd be different if like they were Tops or Upper Deck or, you know, some American empty box, but no, true to Jeremy Lee, they are Canadian Opeachy. Yeah. So I love that. So each one seal that's empty is probably about $150 to $200 each. Now it's funny because empty display boxes in hockey, I remember watching a few months ago, a 1965 Topps hockey empty box sold at auction for over $8,000. There's nothing in it. It's just empty. So some of those actually can get quite expensive and valuable. But unfortunately, you cannot retire on those two boxes.
Well, hey, I got to tell you, you could have told me they were worth $5 or $10 or $20 each, and I would have been just as happy to own them as I am. You know, I just think they're awesome visual representation of the history of these companies. Kids in the 40s, 50s, and 60s would go to the corner store, and these boxes would be sitting on those counters, and they would take a piece of gum and go buy them for a penny. We don't even have. Canada retired the penny several years ago. We don't even have pennies here anymore. So I think that these are just really cool pieces of history that have somehow survived, and I get to be the steward of them now for however long. And again, they sit on my shelf. I enjoy looking at them every single day. And I'm actually very pleasantly surprised with your assessment of them. I didn't think they were going to be worth $150 to $200 each. So that's good news for me, Michael. Thank you.
Generally, tell people where they can find you on Instagram.
Sure. My Instagram handle is at JLee. So for my name is Jeremy Lee, JLee_sportscardslive. That's my YouTube channel is really the hub of my, it's funny to say, I say the hub, but it's YouTube and Instagram. But my YouTube channel is Sports Cards Live, 3 words. You can search that and find me there. You'll find Michael there as well. He's been on the show with me before. If you were to search Sports Cards Live and Michael Osaki, you'll find the show that you and I did together 3 years ago, probably at this point. So that's where you can find me.
Wonderful. Well, Jeremy, thank you for the time today. Love it. Some great tips about the National, and look forward to seeing you at the end of July in Chicago.
As do I, Michael. As always, thanks for having me, and I love to see you doing a podcast. So I'm excited to listen to this and all your other episodes.
Thank you, Jeremy. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.